celebrating success, learning from legends, and growing poppies. This is Tall Poppy Talk with Grace Lewis.
Kia ora and welcome to Tall Poppy Talk. Today, we have Mark Berridge. He is a multi-award-winning author, a TEDx speaker, and an experienced business leader. There's a lot we're going to talk about today, but just to give some background, in March of 2019, Mark's life changed in an instant when a biking accident resulted in a severe spinal injury, triggering a personal battle to overcome and navigate the valleys and peaks of life. And he holds true to this message that you can do hard things. Taking his extensive corporate expertise, combined with this life-changing experience and the lessons he's gained, he provides a unique lens to inspire others to pursue their potential. Mark, he shares these lessons not only with individuals or groups, but organizations as well through public speaking, and he aims and is a beacon of hope. In other capacities, to try summarize it, Mark, you are a council member at Griffith University, a resilience coach, a motivational speaker, a senior associate, director, a dad, and a husband, and you have been praised for your authenticity, openness, expertise, and practicality as well. So with all that and more in mind, it is an absolute pleasure to welcome you today to Tall Poppy Talk. My first question is, where and how are you today?
Absolutely delightful to hear all that, of course. I'm in Brisbane, Australia, where we're sort of on the back end of our winter or into early spring, and it's been pretty beautiful weather, I have to say. We're very blessed at the moment. So it's our early morning. There's lots of lovely blue sky out there. It's a lovely morning for me.
Oh, I love it. And when we were teeing up times to do the interview, you were like, oh yeah, I'm up early, 7 a.m.'s fine. So are you, early bird as opposed to a night owl?
Yeah, I think I've always been relatively early, maybe not so much through university. Certainly once our kids were not sleepers. We did not get blessed with three great sleeping children. So I think for the last, well, the oldest is now 22. So the last 22 years, I've probably been a very early waker. And my big accident that you referred to in the intro, you know, was a cycling accident, a bicycle accident. And, you know, I guess I had a real habit of being up early for that as well. So yeah, no, this morning I probably would have been up and out of bed about 5.
Well, thank you for spending your morning with me and with the podcast. And as I mentioned in that intro, award winning doesn't quite summarize it. You've got 16 awards for this book that you've written, and you've got a whole career, like corporate expertise, all of that stuff. There are so many different avenues when I'm preparing for this conversation with you of like, what do I want to ask Mark? Because he's a well of knowledge and wisdom, and where do I want to take this? So to start, leaving out these words of author, speaker, how would your family and friends describe you? Let's get an even fuller picture.
Well, how would they describe you? How would I hope they describe me? I mean, let's just pick up where you finished there. I mean, I think of all the things I always wanted to be the most was to be a husband and father, and you know, I think to do that well is probably, you know, the greatest legacy, you know, that those of us that want that pathway can probably leave on this planet. And so yeah, really, you know, I guess committed to try and do that as well as I can, and very blessed to have three amazing children and an absolutely, you know, wonderful wife, Lucy. So I'd hope that people thought of me as being loyal, dependent, caring, generous, fun at times, well, probably hopefully fun quite a lot, friend. But I did actually poll somebody just to put them under the bus there. So that's Matt. So that my mate Matt, if he's got it wrong out there, you can hunt him down and kill him, other friends. No, that's not true. I wouldn't have any of my friends do that to my other friends. And I loved what he wrote. And I'm going to read it out because it challenges me as well. So that's nice. So strong values, particularly around family and friends. Gives without question. Receives with too many questions. Don't a few of us do that? So we chip away at the compliments, or we discount it somehow, or we don't quite, I don't know, give ourselves the gravitas and the credit that we should. Humble and thoughtful, yeah, I really like those. Engaging, wonderful communicator. Well, I started to ask too many questions about wonderful. That might be too strong a word. Could we go less than that? Involving and sharing, and friend for life. So, yeah, absolutely touched that Matt was kind enough to put those words across when I thought, well, I better just make sure that what my version of how I'd like to be described is similar. Yeah, so I think, you know, authentic, determined, you know, committed, goal-focused. I like those words too.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you to your friend as well. Like, those are really special words. And when you sent that out, the request of, oh, can you put it through a few words together? Did you expect to kind of feel that touched by what came back?
No, like, you know, on his notepad with some sticky notes that he'd thrown together the words and put it together beautifully. And yeah, I was completely touched. And of course, yeah, you're just sort of, you know, he's a very, very generous friend. And I guess I was expecting, you know, something nice, but it's still really lovely that it's what you get. But also, you know, that he was honest enough to call me out on the things that I need to work on, which is great. And sometimes I talk about this example of just driving to school with my youngest boy, who's now in year 12. And I gave him a compliment and he just turned to me and said, thank you. And I thought, how often do I do that? Yeah, how often do I do that? Do I just discount the thank you when I should pause and take it and just take it in its simplicity? I just thought that was just such a easy thing to do in a simple lesson.
Definitely had this conversation with friends before where you go, how am I supposed to respond to a compliment? You either go, I think I did this or that. I don't know. What do you reckon? I said like too many times. I'm like, no, you didn't. Or you go, oh, that means so much coming from you because you do A, B, or C. Like, you want to either deflect onto the other person or kind of find the negatives in what you did, as opposed to just being able to go, thank you.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah, exactly right. And yeah, it's something we need. I think perhaps it comes back to the show in some ways, that tall poppy syndrome and not wanting to, you know, training ourselves to be part of the herd as opposed to training ourselves just to be ourselves. And you know, those, you know, I guess that ability just to take the compliment for us in that moment where we're at. And of course, we say about speeches, there's always, you know, two speeches, the one you did give and the one you meant to give. And only one person knows two. And so only one person is running the comparison with two of the gaps and, you know, the little words you might have not quite got out clearly, or the little sentences that you really wanted to nail perfectly, you didn't quite get. So you'll think about those, but of course everyone else is just thinking about the experience they actually had. And so how do you let go, I think, of let go of that gap? And yeah, that's one of my future books I want to write, about that sort of feeling about that gap. How do we sort of see the gains we made rather than the gap? I know there's a book that's very much down that title phrase already, but yeah, how do we really aim high and encourage ourselves to keep aiming high despite the fact we might fall, you know, short of that, and we don't punish ourselves for those shortfalls. We sort of, you know, just keep aiming high.
Even with the podcast, I'm going to edit this multiple times before it goes live because I want to listen to it back, make sure the audio is this and that. And then by the time it comes out, it's not new to me because we spoke it the first time. I did all the research in advance. I did this. And then I'll always try to get like a gut check with typically my mom or my sister or my friend. And I go, oh, what'd you take away from it? And it's always so many different elements than what I've taken away because, to your point, they're hearing it for the first time. For me, it's something that I've thought about a lot. I've really sat with it. It's almost not old, but you've forgotten the big shininess of what someone else is experiencing for the first time. And I think we can do that with our own personalities and how we walk out into the world as well. As I might leave an interaction and be like, oh, was I a bit much or was I this? Because you're prone to go to the gap to what you say, as opposed to thinking, this person's like just interacting with me for a minute and they're going to keep moving on. So I think what you said there about speaking applies to everything as well.
Yeah, totally. And just on that, I'd like to acknowledge, you know, how grateful I am for the amount of work you do put into these podcasts and sharing it with the world. You know, amazing stream of podcasts you've done, but you do so much preparation for them. And, you know, that we should all be very grateful for that.
Oh, Oh, well, thank you. And speaking of, actually, on that vein, I have a series of questions I really want to get to. But to take it that step back, if there's a listener who's tuned in for the first time, I've given the intro and they might go Google and then get your book and stuff. But in this moment, if we're hearing about Mark for the first time, could you please, and it's hard to say, give the elevator version of something that was pivotal, but talk us through this pivotal moment in your life back in March of 2019 and how that changed the course of your life.
Yeah, so corporate leader, been in some big roles. I was working on a project in Salt Lake City to save a whole lot of jobs and generate, improved revenue for this business. And so I'd had an amazing trip there about a month before, beautiful weekend of skiing. And I'm out doing my morning cycle. I'm about to fly out there that night again, and I can't wait to get back on those ski slopes at Salt Lake City and do lots of great work at the workshop. Going around a corner on my bicycle and front wheel just hits this sunken piece of road. So it's suddenly it lost traction with the road a bit. I'm unbalanced on the bike, regain control of the bike. What are my crash options here? I don't think I'm going to make the corner anymore, so I've got to crash. Grassy park straight ahead, that's going to save me. That's the way to go. It'll still going to hurt because I knew I wasn't going to lose enough speed. I'd probably been going 40K downhill, 30K into the corner, and just flew high off the bike the way I hit the pine barriers of the park. And then I found this stormwater drain. Unfortunately, it was 5 foot below ground level. So despite the force of the being ripped off the bike and catapulted in the air, meaning that I sort of assumed the Superman position with one hand out in front. That wasn't enough to save me. The ground showed absolutely no respect, and my helmet got smashed up pretty badly. Fractured a left wrist, left scapula, 3 ribs, crushed 2 vertebrae. Didn't really know about that till I got to hospital. All I just knew was pain was intense and just had to get through that moment and get to hospital. The words when we received the news of the scans in hospital that I'd crushed 2 vertebrae and I had more than 50% compression of my spinal cord. And I think they were the words that freaked me out the most because I didn't really understand enough about biology to know what that meant. But, you know, obviously I know that, you know, a fair bit of my body weight's in the upper half of my body. And suddenly the thing that controls the legs and the power to the legs, is less than 50% operable. It certainly was easy to catastrophize the news and they weren't painting any positive picture. And so really great lessons in that sort of hours that transpired from them there. And of course the weeks as I tried to mentally and physically navigate that.
Thank you, first of all. And a first question that comes to mind in terms of the storytelling element there, this is something that is so pivotal and important to you and your family. Like, this happened to you. Do you find, because you have shared this story so much, you almost disconnect from it? Or is it the opposite? Is it bring you back into it? Like, is it hard to tell that story?
Oh, I can always still feel it. Like, just sort of hits me and like, well, I have to actually concentrate to sit upright. So I'm always got my sort of core muscles on and I can always feel I'm just tensing up a little bit more when I speak about it. But yeah, I guess as you tell the story over and over again, you're a little bit more distant from it. And it's always interesting when I tell a new story for the first time, even when I might have practiced it, it'll cut very deep the first time I tell it live. Or sometimes I choose to go much more vulnerably and much deeper into a story I've told before. And I can feel myself just on the edge of, edge of tears, really. Sometimes, particularly if it relates to the kindness that I received through that journey, and that was so often and so important. So when that happens, it's often very hard to get through that moment. But, even if you're not okay in a moment, doesn't mean you're not okay overall. And we should always, remember that we allow ourselves those moments where we're fragile, because that's human, right? And I actually come back to those words, words that I love to be described. Human is right up there. And I know when I did the very first draft of the book and just the first few chapters, and I shared it with a fellow author that I'd only just met, so that was a bit courageous, but I really wanted to get this feedback from what we called our focus friends. And the first words that came back was, it's just so human. And I couldn't think of a better compliment to, you know, what was probably a relatively poor, you know, first few chapters from an overall quality perspective, but just captured something, you know, just normal, typical person sharing, you know, an atypical event, but not one that, you know, not many, many people go through, very similar tough things.
And the tough things, and as I said in the intro, the you can do hard things. I think your atypical event in your life, yes, this people you're speaking to and the individuals or the podcast in this form, people didn't necessarily have a biking accident, right? But they've had something in their life, or whether it's big or little, that when they're hearing you speak or they're reading your book, they find something in there that connects and helps them get a different perspective.
Yeah, I think I was uncomfortable about writing a memoir. I denied it was a memoir, even though it's like really about a 3-month event in my life for quite a while. And, you know, part of that is that I guess I really wanted people to be able to pick things up and think about their own strength and their own capabilities, rather than, I didn't want to write something about me, and I really wanted to find ways for people to read it and think about themselves. And hopefully, well, I've certainly received feedback that many people have been able to do that. So hopefully it's largely achieved that objective.
Yes, and I think too, when we're talking about the strengths or the things that, like, yes, you've worked and there's been things that have probably since 2019 in particular grown and showed more strength. You already had a lot of strengths, right? That's why you were doing these big trips to the States and seeing a lot of success there. What is an area you think you already had strength in, and then what's an area since this, your incident in 2019, that has now become a strength because of all the growth?
Yeah, well, let's start on the second one first. I think I would like to think I was a pretty grateful and non-judgmental person at the point of the accident. I don't think I was always that in my life. Like, I think earlier in my life, when I was probably 20s to 30s, when I was very career driven, you know, I really just wanted to work out how do I get further up the career tree, because I really wanted to set up a lovely, stable environment for my children. So I think gratitude, I've really learned, it's my go-to coping mechanism away. So I've really learned, I think, to build that muscle of just by practicing it as often as I can, really making sure I express my gratitude for things. And I think I've probably become, I hope I've become less judgmental over my life in total. But I think certainly this opportunity, you know, really helps me think about how do I take the most generous interpretation of things as much as possible?
Generous interpretation, there's a parallel, generous assumptions.
Yes.
So, and for those who haven't heard that, because I only really discovered this concept a few months ago, is taking the most generous assumption of why someone did something or said something. So it's even as trivial as all the dishes are left in the kitchen, right?
Yeah.
It's not because they were lazy. You take a generous assumption of they must have really needed to go and they were going to get back to it later. Just taking the more positive, generous assumption about something, so trivial, but then also taking that to a more serious thing. It's like, oh, someone said something and it sounded mean and maybe they were trying to hurt me. Or you take a generous assumption of, no, they didn't mean that. It came across poorly. Is that kind of how you look at it, with the generosity as well?
Yeah, totally. And I think that, obviously, Brené Brown's, you know, popularized that through her Braving acronym, and G being generosity, and picking up on the definition you've just given of that generous assumptions of people's interpretations, actions, and our assessments of things. So yeah, definitely trying to do that, but also just general generosity in life and making yourself happy. I mean, just, you know, a tiny little thing the other week, lost my own mother. So I've been working through that. And we're just walking to the Brisbane Lions here in our local AFL team game the other week. And there's this lady just having, she's got a walking stick in one hand and she's having to hold onto the building with her right hand because I guess a lot of people that she's walking around, and obviously my mobility's not perfect. So I'm probably not the best person to put out the hand, but I guess in that moment I could see that the building was about to end soon. We were about to hit the crossroads that she had to cross. And maybe perhaps having just recently lost my own mother made me very conscious of the situation. So I just said, you know, are you okay? Are you okay? And she said, I've just need to get to that bus stop over there because that's where I meet my son. We go to the football all the time. So this lovely 86-year-old lady, I just had that opportunity to help her across the crosswalks. And then, you know, for me walking, I don't know what it is, about 800 metres, you know, probably a cave between where we typically park and getting the footy, that's hard work. Like, oh, my body's working really hard to do that. And that was probably one of the easiest walks I've had to the ground after I've put her in the bus stop, and I just feel a bit more buoyant and a bit more, you know, pep in my step. And I just felt good about the world just for having that opportunity to help the lady. I'm sure she probably felt a bit better too, you know, not having to cross in the very busy crowds on the traffic on that corner without anyone else helping her. But yeah, probably had even more value to her, to me, than it had to her. It was a beautiful little moment, I think.
That is a beautiful moment. And also, just to pass on and emphasize my sorry, my condolences for your mum's passing, because that's heavy stuff too. I want to get into this area with the TED Talk, right? Because I just think it's so fascinating, such a feat to be a TEDx speaker. And before that was the book. So before you write A Fraction Stronger, you also wrote this kind of shorter article, maybe a year or a bit afterwards, called Value Every Step. The title is pretty encompassing. You get the gist. It's Let's Value Every Step, which is awesome. But was writing always something you did, or did that become an outlet for your recovery and your kind of reflection?
Used to really enjoy writing as a young child. So I did, and particularly through my teens and early 20s, wrote a lot of poetry and just probably enjoyed creative side. My mum was an amazing artist, silk paintings and sculpture and all sorts of amazing things. She could pretty much do any art she wanted to. I didn't ever have that trait, I think, but I always had the creative element that she also, you know, she had so strongly and trained into us, I think, drilled into us. And they just encouraged us to be curious and to do anything and feel we could do things. And so it was, I think it was an important feature of my working career, that ability to write and to be curious about things and research and to, I guess, summarize when I wrote. So part of my work role, but really a side part of it, if you like, you know, it just sort of probably helped me be effective in my career as opposed to being my career. And yeah, the accident catapulted me back in contact with that creative side, created the accidental author, is the other joke I like to roll out. And initially you're just so, I was so broken during that journey, and I'm getting enough help, and I don't. So I was really quite private, I guess, from how badly it had impacted me physically. About 15 months after, everyone's going through COVID, so everyone's going through some form of disruption. It sort of gave me a blanket to cover up my story a little bit and just show a bit and show, you know, you may never really know all the disruptions that different people are going through. They might show us just a little bit of what's going on. Here's me showing a little bit more of what's been going on for you, for me. That generated a bit of traction, and that sort of set me on the pathway to writing A Fraction Stronger. And so, yeah, I'm really grateful for doing that. And I really did it because I was feeling low. I had a second operation to take these rods out of my back. So in order to give me any hope of walking at all, I had to have 23 centimetres of rods inserted in my back on that first day. And then I'd had them taken out and had some complications of the operation. And I was trying to work part-time, and that wasn't really working out perfectly for me emotionally and draining physically. And so I decided I had to do something that might perk me up a little bit, and I went and jogged a lap around the oval just to prove I could, because the spinal specialist had been very clear I'd never run again, and I'd sort of been training for this for about 9 months. I'd been doing what they call pre-running drills to varying extents, just trying to build up to it. And I just thought, right, you're having a bit of a sook. How are we going to break out of this? Let's go do something hard. And I thought, well, you know, now I've done that hard thing, I might talk about publicly about what I've been going through. And in order to do that, I made myself do another hard thing, which was open up my iPad. And on that iPad, I'd taken down the notes of the first 6 weeks. So from about 2 weeks after the accident, I'd started to note things that were going on, just that I had a record of, I guess, you know, how I felt and I guess how intense it had been so that I didn't forget. And I'd never wanted to open that iPad up. I was so fearful of the way it would hurt me, I think, to read just how tough it was at the start. And I was really proud of myself because I'd done a brilliant job of signaling the struggles, like flagging them without writing so deeply how badly I was feeling that I couldn't read it back at that point in time. I also made myself watch the video of myself trying to walk on day 10, and I'd had one try at watching that before, and I just couldn't watch it. I just broke down in tears, and I broke down in tears as I watched it. But I made myself watch it about four times over and just sort of deal with the fact that watching that video just, it felt like loss to me. I couldn't, like, it was just the symbol of all the memories of just how scared I was, just how hard it was, mostly all of the things that I treasured that I'd lost, you know, playing sport and, you know, being able to pick up, you know, my grandchildren in the future and carry them. That's something that might not ever be in my future, right, from a safety perspective. And all these little things that are lost that I associated with that. So, you know, now I can look back and think about all the things that I've gained as a result of that video and life and the people I've met and the opportunities I've had that are just so different. So, yeah, how do you change your perspectives on things just by working on what you can work on?
Right there, those last few sentences, how quickly you say them, but how long that process actually takes. Because, yes, you can look back now and appreciate the loss and feel for that version of Mark, but he's no less strong than the Mark that is now, because if it wasn't for that Mark who did try to walk, or the Mark who did try to watch that video of day 10 and couldn't, it's all stacked up on top of each other. And I've honestly got chills hearing you talk, so thank you. But my big question there is, how do you feel like you were able to actually make that mind shift and think about the positives, be that beacon of hope, use your voice to help inspire others rather than stay in this feeling of loss?
Well, I think I'm naturally got an optimistic bent on life, so that must have helped. But, you know, I just work on it. Like, again, coming back to walking to the footy ground, if I'm walking with my family, you know, I'm walking as hard and fast as I can. I just can't keep up with them. First thought that goes through my head is, I hate falling behind. And the second thought that goes through, well, at least I'm walking with the hope of improvement. So you just, I think you work on it for life. And I want to compare that to like the physio in the first week. And he just sat me down after about a week and said, Mark, I love your enthusiasm that you're going to work at this so hard and that you're going to get back to part-time work in, you know, potentially 3 months or 6 months. But you've got to realize that your new full-time job is rehabilitation. You've got to do this for the next year. You've got to treat it like it's a career, because that's the thing that's going to, you know, pay off for you in the long run. And you're going to be in maintenance for life. And perhaps come back to your comment, your question. For me, working on that mental side will be for life. I'm in maintenance for that for life. I've got to keep applying I'll have negative thoughts always. I'll have sense of loss always. I'm never going to be the same person, but we're never the same anyway. All of us are always evolving in life. I've just had a big step shift at some point in time, and now I've just got to keep evolving from that step shift. And the more I can evolve to the towards the positive and having an impact on other lives, having an impact on my own life, most importantly, happier I am and happier people around me are. And aren't we always, what's the point of being any other way? But we only got one swing at this, being on the right side of the grass. Got to make while you're on the right side of the grass, you got to make the best of it. So that's what I'll try and do.
Yes, and I really appreciate what you say there about maintenance for life, the mental side. And in your circumstance, there's a few elements to that. And I actually really appreciate that the physio just set that expectation, was like, this is a, like setting that expectation of where this might have happened to you in an instant, but it's going to be a life maintenance. And I think mental health in general is that, right? You're not suddenly, if you're feeling depression or anxiety, you don't completely come out like, oh, cured, done, over that. No, like you can be the most, as you said, optimistic positive person and you're still going to have those valleys and peaks that you kind of emphasize. And where it relates to Tall Poppy and what I'm doing with this podcast is because I catch myself chopping people down sometimes in my mind, right? Like even the other day I saw a different podcast and I was like, oh, they've gained a lot of traction, they've done this, and I felt myself looking for the chop down of like, oh, and then I could catch myself in that moment, which is what feels really rewarding, and go, nah, they're just nailing it. Now let's look at it with a different analytical eye, not one of judgment, but actually go, okay, well, what are they doing? What have they done that's seen success, and try to emulate, not emulate it, but look at it in that positive lens. But to your point about you catch yourself and you do have those moments of negativity, it's a lifelong maintenance because you don't suddenly nail it and you're sorted. You have to keep at it.
Yeah, and then you celebrate the good and keep encouraging yourself to do the good and you know, celebrate the good in others and learn from them. And yeah, you're right. It's emulate's an okay word for it because, you know, you've still got to have your own. It's not copy because emulate, I think there is maybe that element of, you know, admiring something and putting your own lens to it, because ultimately we've got to be true to the way we want to handle things. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. And so how do we create this connection between places we want to be, places we see others in, and what's important to us out of that, and how we then going to take ourselves to our new place?
Yes. And before I ask about the TEDx experience, because I'm so curious, on that topic of Tall Poppy, firstly, please, and there's no right or wrong answer, could you describe what Tall Poppy Syndrome is to you? And then secondly, how you've perhaps experienced or interacted with it?
Yeah, I guess it's that instinctive need we've got to be a herd in some ways. Like we survived as a herd-based crowd, as communities, as tribes, through evolution. And perhaps there's that element of, you know, herd mentality means for Tall Poppy, where, you know, we're sort of trained to blend in, and therefore for most of our lives, for most of us growing up, and I hope it's evolving, you know, when things were unique, different, you know, the taller poppy sticking up from that crowd, we sort of, you know, you pulled it back to the crowd in a little bit, rather than celebrating and how do we get the crowd up to that level. It was the pulling it back down to the crowd sort of perspective. And, you know, I guess in that, you know, so that poppies, you know, all become vanilla. And, well, you know, if you're a champagne poppy, sorry for the pun, you know, you're getting mocked for being a different color. You know, it's a thing. How do we just celebrate our differences? And I think we're getting much better as a society of being tolerant of differences. Now, how do we start to really make sure we're celebrating differences, or you know, rather than accommodating differences? And you know, you see that from an accessibility perspective. You know, historically we were ticking the box around how we built things for, you know, accessibility, and we had very one-dimensional views of what accessibility was. It was someone in a wheelchair rather than all sorts of accessibility. Now we're becoming much more, I guess, you know, accommodating. But how do we start to celebrate? And it's not a cost or a difficulty or impost to accommodate these that were just, you know, I guess physical or other differences. But you know, in life in general, how do we take that uniqueness and I guess celebrate it even more, and that way we just admire someone that's the tall poppy that's sitting up, and how are they doing that, and how do we just celebrate it? Isn't that great that it's actually someone's found a way to get above this field, and not mocking them for the fact that the breeze is going to catch them harder, and they're going to sway more, and they're, you know, going to eventually be blown down because they're the one that's not in the herd of the other poppies.
I really enjoy that description. Thank you. And in your experience with not only writing the book, but then also being a speaker and putting yourself out there, because you are a tall poppy, that is just a fact. How do you feel like you've been conscious, or maybe recognize that you, one, are a tall poppy, or have you felt any of that chopping down as you put yourself out there to public speak and to be an author?
Yeah, so I think, like, I did a bit of speaking in business, but, you know, to get out there and talk about my own private story, I was really scared to start with. And even the TEDx talk, you know, which I will get to, definitely, you know, just put a lot of personal pressure on myself and created a lot of anxiety, if you like, around the event to how to do it well. And that comes back from, you know, one of my things I've got to keep working on is, you know, lower the perfectionism levels and traits. It, yeah, you definitely, like, just the whole, I guess you're trying something, like, you know, 47 years old, fall off a bike, a couple of years later, start trying to be something new of introducing myself to the world as a, you know, keynote speaker and author. It's, you're definitely feeling like, oh, am I up to this? And I think that's where I said, like, that author friend that said, you know, that was just so human. Those little moments of encouragement are what you got to keep, you know, finding and sparking onto and going, well, it's worth putting myself out there because look at these rewards. And you know, I don't need everyone to love the book. I just need it to get in the hands of a few people that need it in this particular moment. That's all I'm aiming to do. And if it does that, how precious is that in this world? If my unlucky but lucky moment becomes a chance to help a few other people navigate their unlucky moments a bit better, well, you know, that's how fabulous is that? What a to cop a little bit of you know, negative reviews, that's, you know, you trade that every day of the week. And I know, like, the day I got one of the, I think probably the day I got the first book award, I think I got my first, like, really scathing review on Goodreads or somewhere as well of, you know, did not finish after 15%, you know, something like always already repetitive and jumps around too much. And I'm thinking 15% and it jumps around too much and it's already negative. Well, whatever. If that's what you think, you know, but it just doesn't seem to make sense to me that you can appraise it like that. And of course, but I just looked at it as being, you know, well, what a great leveler that I'm saying, you know, that's when you put it out there, you got to be prepared for both those two spectrums that you're going to get that one. And just funny that that happened on the same day.
I like what you say there about the spectrums growing of both, because, and this is a stat that I don't know where I got it from, so big asterisk, fact check, that like 10% of people just aren't going to like you. Doesn't matter what you do. You can paint yourself purple because people like purple. They're still not going to like you because of whatever. And when I think about that, truly, it's like the more you put yourself out there, the bigger that 10% will get. Because if you just go around in your day to day and you interact with 20 people and two of them don't like you, okay. But in your instance or in mine, when I'm doing this podcast, you are opening yourself up that 10% might grow bigger and you might hear from it. But also that other 90, sheesh, like, let's focus on that. That's the cool stuff. And so to not limit yourself out of fear and concern of, oh, well, some people aren't going to like me. They're probably not going to like you anyway, because sometimes you don't like people too. They're not everyone is for you, and that is totally okay.
So, I mean, the whole recovery from a spinal cord injury, it was just full of fear, and I was just working on that the whole time. And then, you know, how do I just push myself in that fear? Because good things are actually happening on the other side of that fear. I've just got to find a way to keep pushing myself. And, you know, come back to the life transition to writing and speaking, you know, I find myself holding myself account to the words in that book all the time of, Mark, you know, reach out. You might get a no, but reach out, because, you know that the fear means that there's something good that might happen, and be brave. You know, give yourself a tick in the bravery box for trying rather than not. And you sort of, when you talk about the 10%, et cetera, I love that Seth Godin, it might have been in a Marie Forleo interview, and he just talks about, you know, give me 10 fans that love me over 100 fans that are indifferent every day of the week. If you want to build a new business, like, focus what you're writing about, focus what you're speaking about, focus, you know, what you're passionate about down to those core followers. It doesn't matter if they're 5 or 10 or 20. If you're nailing it with them, they will tell people about it. But if you're just sort of okay for 100, no one's going to mention it and you're going nowhere.
What is so relevant to you, and I'm grateful that life intersects in the way that it does, is authenticity is something that, and the humanness that you have, that's something I've been trying to think about and reflect of. Grace, how authentic are you? Do you act the same? You know, everyone has a work voice. When you're on a work call, or when you're, but I'm like, okay, that's different. But do I do that in real life? Do I finish this podcast and still, like you said, with what you wrote in the book, do I still hold true to those values? And for the most part, I'd like to think I do, but I'm working on it. And that other word is integrity. So what you've talked about there with authenticity, integrity, is if you are doing it with the right intention and truly trying to do good for the world and for yourself, then that fear that exists sort of, it never diminishes or it doesn't become irrelevant, but your capacity to focus on the other stuff just grows because you're operating with this authenticity.
Yeah, I agree. And firstly, I think it's completely okay to have different shades of those values in yourself. Like, so by that I mean, you know, you might be much more open in a family environment than you are in a public environment because that's just you. But so they're not in it, that's not inauthentic to be different there. You can have just, you know, I think you're going to be authentic. It's just to a different degree. And I think that's perfectly okay. And people should be completely self-compassionate about that. I'd like to probably drift back to the start and the, you know, the accident. And because I think it is a great example of what we just spoken about where, you know, when I first was just so panicked hearing, you know, 2 crushed vertebrae, more than 50% spinal cord, I started just digging for certainty. You know, like I asking for more questions about, you know, what are my prospects of walking in? What if I work really hard? What's the best case? You know, what's best care? How do we do this and find a way? And the more I sort of drilled the specialists for certainty, the more vague they got, obviously, you know, because it was a completely uncertain situation. And it was only at the point where I sort of let go of that certainty and just said, well, actually, then uncertainty is my friend. If you can't give me any guarantees as to what this could look like, how do I find a way to make it look like what I want it to look like and go after that? But then I also had to give myself permission for falling short of that ideal if I got to it. So how do I measure myself? I measure myself against, am I showing, you know, will I, on this recovery journey, will I show up in a way that's, you know, absolutely determined, I've given it my all, and I look back at this and in the future and go, you know, I set a great example to my children, I set a great example to my friends and to me of when you're in a really tough position, how you go at something. And I don't write it as directly as this in the book. There might be a hint, but, you know, as well as that positive sense of what I wanted to be, I also knew that my wife had been absolutely incredible when she went through cancer, and I had this feeling of, I'm not going to be the shit parent here. I'm not going to be the one that has a real sook and just doesn't try because it's all too hard. I've got to keep the standards that my wonderful wife kept and as best I can, get somewhere near that and just have a crack. So you just, you know, and all that helped me just drive myself in a fear, but it also meant that I wasn't just measuring myself on the results of having pushed myself into fear per se. It was more on the values and the behaviors as I did that. And so how do we find those ways to celebrate our trying, our effort, our dreams, our imagination, our curiosity for things in ways that aren't just about the results that we might have wanted? Because so often we do discount our own progress anyway. We're not actually seeing the progress we're making when we're doing things. You may not be seeing all the progress you're making on the podcast, the impact you're having on people. You're never going to see that. How the bits of feedback that you're going to be getting are so small compared to what you're actually achieving, and yet you're only going to be measuring yourself on the bits you see. So, you know, how do we measure ourselves differently and be more self-compassionate in the way we're thinking about the progress we're making?
Absolutely. And I think I'll reflect, and any listener's going to reflect and go, yeah, what are my KPIs? what is my measurement? Not only with the book, but then to get to that TEDx element, right? I'm someone who looks at that and I've watched it quite a few times and I'm just like, okay, not only is giving a TEDx talk its own thing and you've got cameras and lights and production and all that element, but to actually decide, this is the inception of the idea and this is the story I'm going to tell, because you could tell your story literally dozens of ways and a different, they'd all be great. So I'm like, how do you, one, pick what you're going to talk about, find a TEDx, like, just tell me about.
Oh, it was an interesting and challenging journey. So Brisbane TEDx, Juanita was there, is there a convener, and so she'd reached out, the TEDx was in October, she'd reached out end of June and just said, look, I'm interested in you speaking in the TEDx. We've pitched you to the board, and this is the sort of idea. And I came back, and I think I put about 2 or 3 weeks into writing two versions of TEDx talks around, really around like that willingness to push ourselves into uncertainty, because you get this positive, you know, the sense of, well, there is just so much possibility, and coming back to almost that sense of, we're trained to control things we can control, and that can be great, and it is important. And I, you know, when I was in the ditch and the pain was so bad, I concentrated on breathing. Like, how do I just stop panicking and breathe, right? So you pick the things you can control, definitely in circumstances. But when you're doing that as well, it's also narrowing your field of vision, your sense of what's possible. And we've got to keep finding ways to lift our vision up to, you know, that uncertainty, because there's so much possibility into the uncertainty. Anyway, so I wrote around this, and I had a couple of really, I think, beautiful speeches, but were they TEDx worthy? Nah. And that was very much the response I got. So I thought, oh God, I spent like 2 or 3 weeks doing these, polishing these two up. You didn't like either. Righto. So I think I wrote 3 half-drafted ideas and then shared those of, you know, not going to put as much effort into getting these as polished because it just didn't work. And I think there was one of those, she goes, well, that's sort of where we're at. So, but what you're really saying is, you reckon people can do hard things. I said, that's absolutely what I'm saying. And so we just did a bit of brainstorming to that idea, and then we started writing to that idea. And we still had quite a bit of, I guess, wrestles in terms of getting a speech that both of us were comfortable with. But ultimately, I got to a point where there was a speech that I believed in, and I think that was so important to me. And again, come back to, I guess, hopefully the themes that have been coming through really strongly so far, that sense, well, you know, I could get up there and fail. I could get up and forget my words, or just, you know, when I'm telling the emotional story, just break down, you know, under all the pressure. And if I'm going to do that, I'm going to do it on my terms. I'm going to do it with words I really, really own and believe, and, you know, I'll feel good about that. I won't feel really good, but I'll be able to reward myself for doing it on my terms with my words, and I'm not going to do it on words I don't believe in, because why would I? Then I feel wrong twice. I feel like I've, you know, anyway. So we got there, and I just did so much pressure. I put pressure on myself. I did so much practice. I was really wanting to get it nailed. I wanted to not have nerves, because my breathing can be a bit shallow if, you know, I'm nervous like any of us. And it was interesting. I didn't really have that impact, but I definitely could just feel, because I knew I was going to push it to the emotional edge from a story perspective, that I could just feel like at the very start, my jaw was so tense. It was so hard to get the words out, and I probably looked bloody fierce as. So there's no doubt that I haven't had that discussion, but I reckon Juanita definitely went for the wide pan zoom to start, because I probably just looked like I'd scare people off at the first three sentences if they had been up close, because I just was so tight in my jaw, and I never quite got the emotional up and down shades that I wanted to in the speech. But, you know, I think it's important. If I had my time just a little bit again, I'd just tweak the speech, because I want it to be about the fact that I had to go really hard, and it really tested all of me. And all my friendships and support were just so crucial, and the unexpected help that come from so many unexpected places. And so I do genuinely believe people can do their own hard things, because I did it. But you can't do it because I did it. You can do it because you've done so many other little hard things before that you're probably not recognizing quite what they were. And all those embers of strength inside you are the things that are going to get you up and get you through that hard moment when you need to get to it. And I just like to pull out that flavor of it just a little bit stronger. I think it is in the closing paragraphs of, you know, imagine what we can all achieve when we're championing these words of, you can do hard things inside of all this. But I don't want people to misinterpret it that I'm saying that you can do something hard because I did something hard. I just know you can find that way to do it because I did it, if you know what I mean. Like, it's in you to do it. You're not doing it because I did it.
It's that humanness and this authenticity that comes across now, and it came across in the TEDx talk as well, of like, that was hard to do. So you're saying the words and you can feel it, right? You're like, okay, this man has gone through all of that hard stuff, but this right now is hard. So he's practicing what he's preaching. That's what I interpreted.
Yeah, well, I wanted it to be a bit easier on the day. I worked so hard so that it'd be a bit easier on the day. And I was a bit bloody miffed that I didn't quite pull it off to the exact emotional way I wanted to. And as one of my author mates pulled me down and said, Mark, it'll be better because it was hard. You're talking about it being hard. It'll be better because it's not perfect. Whatever you think perfect was, this is probably more perfect than whatever you think perfect was. And that's the thing is, right, that it is only ever going to, no matter what version of it I wanted to do, the only version that matters is the way somebody interprets it and what it means to them in that moment. And the way I might be trying to deliver something is never going to be exactly how someone determine it, because exactly we're all tall poppies and we're all unique.
And I love that your author friend said that after you gave the TEDx, is how it was interpreted as someone watching it, and I watched it in the digital form, right, is yeah, if you had gone up there and it had been easy breezy and you were talking about it, I'd almost be like, okay, all right, where's this coming from, you know, like I could hear the story. But to feel it and to see that what you were doing was hard in that moment made it perfect, because you were in that moment practicing what you were saying, and it hit a lot harder as someone watching and really taking in the message.
Thank you. And it was just such a beautiful experience. Like the friends I met, the other people, you know, having the courage to put themselves on that red dot and do it. I just got such amazing friendships. I've got such respect for the things that they're doing and the people that they are. I'm so grateful for that opportunity. And I mean, how fabulous, while I'm walking out on stage, I can see, you know, two of my great friends who spoke immediately before me, Hayley and Jim, rather than going back to the green room, they decided that they got permission to sit on the other side of the stage, and they're just sitting on the other side of the stage, just sitting there watching me, because they wanted to be there live on the side when I spoke. And because I guess we've all practiced together so much, and I guess they've decided to see my story delivered on the day because of they knew how personal it was. And, you know, how beautiful is that? And no matter how well or badly the speech had gone on the day, what could be more special than the cohort you've been through supporting you in that way? Just a truly, truly special thing.
Mark, before I ask my sign-off question, is there anything I didn't ask during this conversation that I should have?
It's been beautiful. I probably didn't answer all the questions perfectly. Writing the book was so cathartic in the end. I never thought it would be, because I thought I'd value every step and beaten that out of me. But, like, you know, again, it's this working on things for life, isn't it? The book was just a next phase of me working through, you know, all those beautiful memories and processing them and things, emotions that I'd probably parked, because I think that's okay when you're dealing with things that are hard. You know, sometimes you're just going to make progress. So it's okay to go, I can't cope with those emotions right now, and find a way to drive myself forward. And if I drive myself forward, my perspectives will change. I'll get new information. I'll be able to reward myself and feel better and then keep making more progress. And if to do that means you park emotions for a period of time, that's okay. But eventually you do need to come back and process them a bit more. And when you're a bit stronger, or like you've got the energy for it, or it's just feeling like the right time, or something triggers them to make it the right time. And so, yeah, I think, you know, I'll have all these evolutions for life of that, just continuing to process all the good and the bad of the you know, the way things have happened. And I'm just so blessed there's been so much good.
Thank you. Now, my sign-off question, just to round out the Mark experience completely, if you had to listen to just one musical artist for the rest of your life, who's it going to be?
Well, not Dave Dobbin's Slice of Heaven. Sorry, New Zealand fans, as much as I do love a bit of that and Foot Rot Flats from when I was a kid. I don't know, maybe, I love the music so much. Maybe Led Zeppelin. I don't know. If you had to listen to Led Zeppelin all the time, though, maybe that'd be too much, too heavy. Missy Higgins. I don't know. There's something very human about Missy Higgins, actually, an Australian artist that, yeah, not so well known around the world, but just really beautiful. And she's busy doing her 20-year anniversary of The Sound of White, which was her breakthrough amazing album at the moment. And she's just gone through a really messy divorce, and she's being vulnerable and sharing about that in a new album and a new tour. And she's the sort of person that makes my heart sing of that's how fabulous people are. And, yeah, it's just beautiful to as a role model for all of us of it's okay to be like that. You don't need to be, you know, appear perfect just because you've had incredible success and you've got incredible talent. And how lovely that she's just always prepared to, you know, I guess be her.
Be human. To come back to you and everything that we've talked about in this podcast.
And of course, my wife absolutely loves Missy Higgins. So probably in terms of company, I'd probably be on the track to divorce if I was playing Led Zeppelin all the time rather than Missy Higgins. So let's go with that much safer, a much more human answer than Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, a little bit more realistic. Mark, thank you so much for your time today on Tall Poppy Talk. I will make sure we link to your book, to the TEDx talk, everything else. But to have this one-on-one conversation with you means so much to me. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners.
Thank you so much for listening to Tall Poppy Talk. We'll see you next time. Feel free to check us out on socials, YouTube, and the website. Thanks for today's guest.